Welcome back to Acid Horizon and Ask a Left Meechin. You're probably wondering why I'm driving. Well, I'm finally allowed to again. We'll get to that later, but I just wanted to say welcome back. And the reason I'm doing this actually is, well, kind of fucked up the live stream recording from earlier this week. And I just wanted to make sure that our promotion, our support of Moral Minority, which features our guests today, Devin Gouret and Charles Dashings, got a huge shout right at the top of this episode. You can navigate to the show notes and click on the link to their podcast and add it to your rotation. Today's episode begins with Devin talking about precisely his work with Moral Minority and things that he's doing with Nietzsche. And so we're just gonna slide right into that after I'm done yapping here. But also, in the meantime, please join our Patreon account. On our Patreon account, you can join our reading groups. Also, that supports us, and you'll get the message for anything that we're doing, any other live stream events, and so forth. Also, it's there you can find our publications, Anti-Oculus, A Philosophy of Escape, and The Philosopher's Tarot, and forthcoming publications like the one we mentioned, One or Several Nietzsches. We talk about this in the podcast that you're about to listen to. Anyway, I gotta keep my eyes on the road, make sure there's no wild turkeys, deer, bear, you know the deal. And let's cruise on in to Ask a Left Meechin. We're talking about the Ubermensch.
And we've explored a few different traditions and perspectives on this basic question of this kind of meta-ethical question, where do moral values come from? What justifies them? So we've talked about Nietzsche, as you mentioned. We've talked about Alasdair MacIntyre's attempt to reconstruct a kind of Aristotelian virtue ethics and after virtue. Our last episode tried to tease out a more sophisticated Kantian perspective on morality in Christian Korsgaard's Sources of Normativity. But going forward, we're trying to kind of tie these together in a narrative that focuses on relating these kind of seemingly abstract and really rock-bottom philosophical questions about the origins and sources of morality and justification, and why we should really think about these as being live for us in our daily activities and in politics as we understand it. Why it really is important for us to engage with these philosophical questions to make sense of the practical identities we live today. So Charles, I'm going to let Charles go into a little bit more detail about our overall project here and what we've been up to at Moral Minority.
Thank you, Devin. And thank you, Will and Craig, for having me on for the first time. We really appreciate this opportunity to talk about our own ongoing project of Moral Minority. I won't have too much to add to Devin's eloquent presentation of the general thrust of our project, other than emphasizing how important, how unavoidable, how necessary value is. Value is something that suffuses our being in the world. It's something that confronts us as necessary, that makes demands upon us. And the question of value, or the problematic of value, is something that has been an ongoing legacy of Enlightenment, specifically the Enlightened project of trying to find a new ground for morality, absent a divine command or the arbitrary whims of some sovereign. So we're looking for, since the Enlightenment, some kind of rational ground or some kind of justification for our norms. And norms have everything to do with truth, meaning, beauty, and just how we treat each other, what our obligations are to each other, whether we even have obligations. So the overall project of Moral Minority is to try to elaborate on that Enlightenment project, assess its success or failures, and see where we are. Do we have reason? Are we justified in our moral foundations?
Yeah. And I would say, relating it to what we're going to be talking about in a little more detail today, I think this is also the question that Nietzsche is grappling with in his discussions of the Ubermensch in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. This is also a question of how do we create new values? And that responds in some fundamental way to modernity, the problem of modernity, the problem of the new in modernity, and the Enlightenment and its attempt to put morality on new grounds of kind of rational autonomy rather than the inherited grounds of a Christian metaphysical tradition in Christian metaphysical tradition. And I do think that's really getting to the heart of what Nietzsche is up to in Zarathustra in general.
Great. It's great to have you back on, Devin, and great to meet you for the first time, Charles. And to make things clear, once this episode is printed either in podcast form or if I re-upload it as a video, I'll be sure to put a link to Moral Minority in the show notes. Click on it, subscribe to them, check it out, and make that part of your weekly rotation. Okay, let's do it. Let's talk about Übermenschen. And I'd like to start by finding out who or what they are. Who is an Übermensch? Via negativa, by dispelling some common misconceptions. There is a particular caricature, strand of popular discourse, which sees the Übermensch as someone who is indeed intent upon surpassing their fellow human beings in virtue of reaching out for a particular ideal that demands achieving a set of attributes or accolades beyond your average person, right? But it might be someone who's committed to acquiring an ensemble of material advantages as well, like real power, everything from money to status to a trophy case of sexual conquests. And these are images that are often conflated with the archetype of an alpha male, or perhaps what they now call the sigma male, right? Who's a relatively newer figure on the scene of dominant male archetypes. But then you have someone in the pantheon of American demigods, a real person who has without a doubt exceeded all of the demands of these mythic alpha and sigma male figures. And that person is boxer Mike Tyson, perhaps one of the greatest, if not the greatest practitioner of his craft, and who is known to have been a fan of both Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. And we can presume that Mike had a decent reading of Nietzsche, at least compared to these other guys. If we take a look at the following quote that I'm about to read, Mike Tyson said, "I can take anything. I think about Nietzsche a lot. I know what the Overman is, but how much of my balls do I have to chop off to be this new guy?" I think that's interesting. I don't think there's any getting around Tyson's crassness here, but what stands out to me is probably that his understanding of Nietzsche's Overman is a little bit better than your average jock, right? Who might have conventional views on gender. And this isn't to say that Nietzsche himself has these enlightened views on gender, but maybe bouncing off this ensemble of reactions to the name Übermensch or the figure of Nietzsche himself, how can we dispel some of these myths about who or what the Übermensch is, and maybe unpack what might have triggered some of Mike Tyson's anxieties?
Yeah, it is interesting. Mike has a more insightful reading, I think, of the Übermensch than somebody who would take this to be a figure in the here and now that has accumulated some kind of power or superiority over the common man. If we look at Zarathustra's speech on the Overman at the beginning, in Zarathustra's prologue, we find that it's much more focused on, as you suggested, Craig, the kind of via negativa, the contrast with the Overman, which is current mankind or current humankind that needs to overcome itself and go under in order for the Overman to be possible. But in order to get a sense of what that goal is, where we're kind of trying to get to, I think we do need to dispel some of the common myths about Nietzsche's concept. So to start with the word itself, some translators will leave Übermensch untranslated. R.J. Hollingdale's translation gives Superman, whereas Walter Kaufman's translation gives Overman. So I think I've been working hard on my German throughout this Nietzsche project, but I will of course defer to any German speakers who want to correct me here. But I take it the more colloquial and commonly used version or the translation would be Superman. So we would translate it, the DC Comics hero would probably be translated into German as Übermensch. But I think there's something crucial that's being missed here, which is that the prologue, Zarathustra's prologue, and really the rest of the book, focuses very heavily on the contrast between over and under, heights and depths, as a kind of structuring metaphor of the book. And that contrast is also related to the structuring temporal metaphor of the book, which is the passage of the sun across the sky throughout the course of the day, and it's kind of different moments of dawn and noon and midnight. And what we see when we look particularly just right off the bat at the first passage of Zarathustra's prologue is that the prefix ubo is used multiple occasions to signify this concept of overflowing, of having some kind of excess or a superabundance that has to be, has to brim over as water brims over the rim of a cup when it's full and be bestowed as a kind of gift upon others. And what I think this kind of shows is the way that the Ubermensch is operating for Zarathustra, and it really is, and I think I want to emphasize really strongly that the figure of the Ubermensch is almost exclusively located in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. So there are, of course, references to this in Nietzsche's notes as he's developing the plans for Thus Spoke Zarathustra and elsewhere. There is a comment, of course, a famous comment about Napoleon as a combination of the inhuman and superhuman. And there's a passage I would suggest at the end of the second essay of the Genealogy of Morals that does refer directly to the Ubermensch as the kind of conqueror of God and nihilism and conqueror of God and nothingness. But it's important to understand that rather than representing an actual figure that somebody, a person, could embody, first and foremost, the Overman takes its place within the system of symbolic references that constitutes Thus Spoke Zarathustra as a work. And it's not just the contrast between human and overhuman. It's also the contrast between animals with animals, plants, earth, and other features of the living world that all take up new places in a kind of symbolic constellation in the discourse of Zarathustra.
Great. Charles, did you want to add anything to that?
It's hard to add anything, although I will say that the themes and the figuration of the Ubermensch does appear, I think, in Dawn. Dawn begins with a preface where there's this mole-like figure, this underminer. So we once again, we have this figuration of the under and the above that begins in Dawn. And our first episode actually addresses this.
Hmm. Great. You know, I think right off the bat, and I had this fresh copy. This might be like the Barnes & Noble copy of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Like, I just had it on my shelf. I'm like, ah, what the hell? We'll break it out. It's fresh because the other ones are all marked up. And it was nice reading a fresh copy because I was able to see things on the page that, you know, weren't, that my highlights were not directing my attention away from. And in particular, just the idea that the Ubermensch is a figure associated with a kind of sacrifice really stands out here. Whereas this common or conventional conception of an Ubermensch is kind of a taker. He wants to get like all this stuff. He wants the big muscles, the big car, he wants all the girls, you know, like that's the way this caricature is kind of bandied about. Moreover, it's almost like sacrifice on steroids in a sense, or at least an accelerated form of sacrifice insofar as the saints of the orthodoxy or the priests of the orthodoxy say to Zarathustra, no, what you want to do is you want to take the burden away from man. You want to carry it for them. You want to maintain this kind of heaviness. Whereas the figure of Zarathustra almost, in some sense, and this might be blasphemy, probably is, goes beyond the figure of Christ in terms of his or her kenotic character, like an overflowing, and one whose pedagogy is to teach others to overflow in the same way. Maybe you could speak to the sacrifice piece a little bit more, Devin.
Yeah. So I think the first, and I think going back a little bit more to the question that you had previously, I think the first relevant contrast to make is between the Ubermensch figure and, exactly as you say, the level of sacrifice or going under or kind of jettisoning of old values that will have to occur to make the Ubermensch possible, rather than the idea of someone accumulating power. The first contrast is, I think, with the aristocrats or masters in the first essay of the Genealogy of Morals. So I think this is the first kind of conflation that is often made, that Nietzsche kind of has in mind, a kind of powerful aristocrat who leads over the herd and can impose values through will. So I think what we'll see is, in Zarathustra, that figure appears as the lion in the Three Metamorphoses. And Nietzsche is very clear that while the lion can deny and repudiate the old values, he is unable to give birth to new values. It will take the child to give birth to new values. I take it the child then and the final metamorphosis is what represents the passage to the new beginning, that is the Ubermensch. But in particular, when Nietzsche talks about aristocrats and masters in the genealogy, this is very much a past, a long past example of society that shouldn't be taken as a model for what Nietzsche has in mind with the Übermensch. In fact, Nietzsche has in mind the opposite. In order for the Übermensch to be possible, we'll need to incorporate and make into instinct all of the knowledge that we have gained throughout modernity and in, as a result of natural science and developments in science and philosophy. That this presents humankind with a kind of new tragic knowledge that the aristocrat of old was never presented with, that creates new and more interesting spiritual challenges requiring different sorts of will to power to incorporate and overcome. And this is, I take it, what Zarathustra is really about. And one of the key contrasts is the one I think you know that's going to come up pretty clearly in the second passage of the prologue, where we get the contrast between Zarathustra and the figure of the saint. So as you mentioned, we have all of these images, as we talked about, we have all these images of overflowing excess in the first passage. The sun, which is this classic Neoplatonic and also like Apollonian symbol, if we want to go back to Birth of Tragedy, appears as a figure of excess that not only has more than enough power that then needs to overflow and be bestowed, but also in some sense finds its justification through those upon which it can bestow that excess power. Zarathustra, in turn, wants to compare himself to the sun and say he's accumulated this overflowing power that will now need to overflow upon humankind. So Zarathustra's downgoing or going under that comes at the end of the first passage could be seen in along that model of, you know, water fully filling up a cup and then flowing over and coming down upon the sides once it gets full. And that will provide an interesting contrast in the second passage between how Zarathustra talks about love and how the saint he encounters in the woods talks about love. And I think we can read this saint in some ways as Nietzsche's past. I think you could argue that this is maybe Zarathustra confronting a memory of himself coming out into the wilderness originally, where he was still under the influence of Schopenhauer and this kind of negativity about life and disgust in humankind. So it's clear that when in this exchange, when Zarathustra just flatly says, "I love humankind," the saint understands this as the pitying, sympathetic love that is kind of fellow suffering with other human beings and their kind of misery or suffering or dissatisfaction with life. This is posed as a kind of direct contrast with Zarathustra's love, which instead comes from superabundance of power that then must bestow as a result of its excess. And we have, I think, the first kind of repudiation or the first figure that will contrast with the overman in Zarathustra is this saint figure that is disgusted and tired of mankind and therefore has to flee into the woods. That passage will conclude with Zarathustra saying, "Well, doesn't he know that God is dead?" And the next speech that Zarathustra opens with in the subsequent passage is, "I teach you the overman." So I think that contrast should be seen as the direct kind of preface for the initial teaching of the overman in Zarathustra.
I'll ask one more question before I get Will into the discussion, who's with us here today. Maybe just to firm up the distinction between the downgoing and the overgoing. How would an Übermensch navigate this tension between a kind of filling up and going down? I mean, certainly this happens within the story of Zarathustra. Zarathustra takes mm-hmm. to the mountains. He engages in a kind of spiritual exercise that lasts for about 10 years. He builds himself up spiritually in some way, and then, of course, goes down to the people to deliver his insights. But it seems that there's like a distinct psychological or perhaps even metaphorical shift that takes place between the overgoing and the downgoing. And what does that like? How does an Übermensch know when they are full? How do they know when they are ready to impart this knowledge or wisdom to others?
Yeah, this is a critical question, because what we find in the prologue is, of course, that Zarathustra's initial attempt fails. He finds himself with only a dead man as a companion, again, alone in the woods, and in need of people upon whom he can bestow his wisdom. And this kind of goes back to this confrontation with the saint. So, for example, in Robert Gooding Williams' interpretation of Zarathustra, Zarathustra's Dionysian modernism, he presents the saint's disgust, this encounter with the saint and his disgust for humankind as this initial challenge to Zarathustra's ability to create new values. And I think what's important here is, in what I come back to, is rather than seeing the overman as a person, as instantiated or embodied in a person, I do think we should see it as playing a metaphorical function in Zarathustra's text of problematizing the question of what it would mean to truly put a goal or a value over humankind. So what it would take to justify a value as being greater than simply a self-interest or life itself. And Zarathustra and Nietzsche himself is, of course, going to present Zarathustra as giving humankind a goal. And the Overman figure is problematizing this question of how one breaks with the past and creates new values. And the saint's objection to Zarathustra, perhaps the reason he laughs as Zarathustra leaves him, is that he perhaps predicts or foresees that Zarathustra's attempt to dispense wisdom on humankind as it exists in the form he finds it in the marketplace is destined to fail, that it's going to throw Zarathustra back upon both his solitude and upon what Zarathustra will increasingly confront throughout the book as his greatest danger, which is his disgust or contempt for man and for the smallest man. And just as a note here, I think when we translate this, the word is German word consistently as Mensch, which should be straightforwardly translated as human being, although previous translations would say man as just the antiquated gendered sense. I think there's an interesting reason to sustain or continue to use man in certain contexts, like the last man, because I do think it can call attention to a certain connection between the history of nihilism and its morality and a certain connection to patriarchy and masculinity that could be interesting to interrogate. But to be clear overall, the functional concept here is humankind as a whole, the human animal. And Zarathustra at the end of the prologue finds the teaching of the Overman to have failed. The crowd tells him in the marketplace, we want the last man. Zarathustra finds himself, and we can touch on the tightrope walker and the metaphor there. But Zarathustra finds himself again alone in the woods and now looking more selectively for companions rather than trying to dispense his wisdom upon humankind as a whole. And I take this to be an important shift. And I think it's also a shift that marks a movement away from Zarathustra as teacher of the Overman, which is the beginning of the book, towards Zarathustra as teacher of the Eternal Return, which is the mature Zarathustra that we find at the end of the book. This is a point that Heidegger also makes in his reading.
Great. Will, go ahead. Get in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's super important to talk about Nietzsche's cosmology in the context of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which I think is what's fundamentally lost in these kind of cheap interpretations of the Overman. But more importantly, I really want to sort of pin down the way in which the Overman is actually used lexically in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. I really have to stress Devin's point that it is not instantiated. It is always either something that follows a preposition, a verb, right? It's a mode of engagement with a particular organization of human value and importantly of, let's say, like human society, right? So the first time the Overman is mentioned, it is taught. I teach you the Overman. And this has a series of really important implications for Zarathustra and things that he learns along the way for having taught it. And the first one is, in teaching the Overman and the way in which he taught it, he approaches the entire population of a town called Motley Cow, right? And the sort of tragic telling of these last people, a people of pure security, a people who are self-managed, self-rationalizing, is deeply appealing precisely because for Zarathustra, he's forcing them to be crushed by a statue. He's sort of imposing a particular pedagogy onto the town of Motley Cow. And we get the final kind of consequence of this error on the part of Zarathustra with this, frankly, kind of problematic, ableist, and a little racist figure of Zarathustra's ape, right? Who has taken up precisely this obsessive disposition that humanity will look upon, or the Overman looks upon humanity in the way that humanity looks upon its predecessors, and has precisely the opinions of the very people that we would say sometimes deploy the Overman or Ubermensch in a very particular way. So I think that a lot of what the way in which we approach the Overman has to prioritize two things, which is precisely how it's used as a kind of way to destabilize a particular liberal modernist analytic, like a very particular kind, and the way in which the Overman is a figure in Nietzsche's cosmology. Because yes, I'll agree with Charles that yes, the Overman is in Dawn, but it's far more important that Zarathustra is placed elsewhere, because it all returns to Zarathustra's relationship to the Overman that I think is most important. Because what's changing throughout the book, and like perhaps I'm too reliant on kind of wild interpretations like Paul Loeb's, which I think is a little...
No, I think Paul Loeb gets a lot of things right. Now, I'm generally very sympathetic to this. The eternal return as the ground concept or ground work, ground thought has not been... Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a
wacky one, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a really wacky interpretation. And I was talking to Paul Loeb when I was a master's student, and I just asked, like, do you believe in the eternal return? And he was like, when I started reading Nietzsche, no. Now I do. He's like, I completely believe in eternal recurrence. Like, and it was a wild ride. But yeah, so these, you know, there has to be a difference between memorizing the phrasing and tone of Zarathustra, which I think produces this awful kind of interpretation of the Overman, and an understanding of the Overman as this is going to sound so deflationary, but I don't want it to. But like Overman as critique, like Overman as critique into Overman as not an imperative, but a kind of relationship to the history of man. And that's what makes Zarathustra cry. It's like, we actually have to have this strange, tragic history that he despises so much. It's necessary. Exactly. And that's why Zarathustra weeps. So there's so much to this book that is, like, I actually don't think this book is exhaustible. So I think that the Overman is just tragically abused.
In the future, there may yet be chairs, academic chairs, in the study of Zarathustra.
Yeah,
I just says it. But I know Charles wanted to touch on, and I think we should look at very closely, the phrasing of Zarathustra's speech introducing the Overman, and the way that the Übergehen and Untergehen, or the going over or crossing over versus going under, operates, and that kind of distinction. But I do want to go back to something that Will said importantly about the relation between teaching Zarathustra's figure as a teacher, and also the point about Nietzsche's cosmology. So one thing I take to be very important is that in the note in August of 1881, that Nietzsche scribbles down the night he claims to have had the revelation of the eternal return, specifically talks about this idea of incorporation, which will be an important figure, an important concept in the gay science.
To return to what Will said about Zarathustra as critique, but as something beyond critique, in the preface, Nietzsche gives us a kind of theory of human nature. He says, what is great about human beings is that they are a bridge and not a purpose. What is lovable about human beings is that they are a crossing over and a going under. And what I love about this passage is it shows the insufficiency of just mere critique, and which is symbolized by the lion who has turned to devour or do this deconstructive work of critiquing all pre-existing values. But what the Übermensch and what Zarathustra presages is that this project has failed. Deconstructive work is not enough, that we must imagine ourselves above this ingrained, inherited theology of purpose. We should see value as imminent, as springing forth, as not a definitive end which we strive for. We don't strive for the good as something beyond us. The aiming is the purpose. It's the crossing over. It's the creation of bridges.
I want to sort of prioritize that on the notion of immanence, right? Because we also have to remember, like we're the Deleuze podcast, so I know that like sometimes we prioritize that kind of approach to Nietzsche, but I'm just going to say, like, Deleuze is fundamentally wrong to say that Hegel is Nietzsche's primary target. It is absolutely a particular kind of Platonism that reached its peak in scholastic interpretations of Aristotle. Like, when it comes to the relationship between value and immanence, where this sort of arrival at a singular point of the good, like for Nietzsche, this springing forth, and if you're interested in a historical understanding of that springing forth, Foucault's essay Nietzsche Genealogy History starts with a philology of that term, is, I think, important to Nietzsche's attempt to overturn a particular kind of metaphysics as well. Like, so one of the things that I think that Nietzsche does very well, which has to be taken into account when we talk about the Übermensch, is for him, concepts don't just have a sort of monotonous development through history, but in fact are mendacious. You know, and for that reason, like Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour said, like, don't trust his lies. Like, that's part of the game with Nietzsche. Is Nietzsche's like, don't trust me, and don't trust Kant, and don't trust Hegel, and don't trust, like, because the whole operation is historically imminent and imminent to the process of the production of those values. So I think that's what's actually occurring to and from Zarathustra's work throughout the text, which is why I think Nietzsche always believes that, like, if you actually want to understand what he's doing, you really first have to truly get the grasp, which I think is actually kind of impossible, of what's going down in Zarathustra.
We have Devin back in the stream.
Yeah, sorry, everyone. Yeah. My computer sucks and just crashed. Subscribe to More Minorities Patreon so I can buy a new computer, not crash.
That's how you do it.
Middle of episodes, everyone. I thought the tail end of what I heard from Will sounded great. But I did, just to finish what I was saying before I cut out, the point about teaching does come up very explicitly in the note in August 1881, that Nietzsche presents his act of teaching the doctrine of the eternal return as the best way for him to incorporate the doctrine. And this idea of incorporation as making into instinct, or the kind of operation of transforming what is conscious into something unconscious and instinctual, and thus a kind of second nature. This is deeply related to the concept of the eternal return as the greatest heavyweight that is the most difficult to incorporate. And so we can see Zarathustra as quite explicitly a figure for the task of teaching as a form of incorporation. And I think with respect to this cosmology, the shift here at the end of the prologue is important in that the eternal return is, and this I think gets into some of the most difficult and problematic aspects of it, is intended as a selective principle. There is an intended distinction between a form of life that's able to incorporate the thought and joyously affirm eternal return, and a form of life that's sick from this existence, suffers, and therefore finds the thought of eternal return unbearable. And I think that the contrast here is when Zarathustra is teacher of the Overman, he is still lacking in the selective principle that will yield the Overman as this new type or new nature. He is still trying to bring his message to humankind in general, rather than bring it through a process of selection to which he himself will have to be subjected throughout the course of the book, because the course of the book will be Zarathustra learning to affirm the eternal return. And I do think that is where we do have to connect to Nietzsche's cosmology, have to situate the Overman as a figure in that cosmology. Look, I'm, take it with a grain of salt as somebody who's a bit of a madman, but I think I too believe in the eternal recurrence at a deep level as a metaphysical concept. And I do think that Nietzsche intended to demonstrate it in some fashion, even if this was only his sort of esoteric doctrine that he had scribbled in notes. But he did seem to take seriously some prospect of a scientific demonstration or proof of eternal return. and thought that this was perhaps important for confronting humankind with this thought with sufficient force to break history in two in the way that he intends.
I have a question regarding the shift that happens at the end of the prologue. It actually attends to something that I'm writing in the book that we're working on together. And I'm going to loop that back into a criticism of Will here at the end, but we'll get to that part at the very end. I do believe that Deleuze makes Hegel a kind of ultimate target, at least in Nietzschean philosophy. It's in that chapter that he connects the concept of the Overman to an attack on the dialectic. And I think in a way that's so specific to what we're talking about here in the prologue. So the thing that I want to focus on that seems like a grace note in the prologue is the moment that Zarathustra takes a long rest. I mean, it happens in a single sentence, right? And I mean, the way that I imagine it is like, you know, you have those nights where the cat's waking you up, you know, there's a thunderstorm outside, there was a turkey on my metal roof the other night, you know, I couldn't get a good night's sleep. But then you have that singular night of sleep where it's almost coma-like and you wake up and it's like you're in another world. And in, I think it's part 9 of the prologue, mm-hmm. where Zarathustra almost has this like lightning-esque flash of insight. And he's struck by this desire to find companions. And it seems that he doesn't want to attract followers in the traditional sense. In other words, he doesn't want those who are content with this sort of dichotomy between herdsmen and herd necessarily. And it's not that he's trying to gather up a coterie of herdsmen, right? This is a sort of maybe like I would call like a right-wing reading of it. Rather, he's looking to unsettle the established orthodoxy of values. He talks about breaking the table of values, which on one level is the way that we ordinarily think this distinction between herd and herdsman, leader and follower. And he has this idea of community and this idea of companions versus followers. But at the same time, there is a kind of following that he suggests, that you follow yourself. And I will follow those people who follow themselves insofar as they will the same place that I will, or they follow the same will that I will. And this is what seems either so sublime and almost transcendent in a way, even though I'm sure Nietzsche would not put it in those terms. But the question that I have for you here is, what is significant about that rest or repose? Do we see this in other places in Nietzsche? Because what I think it's fundamental to the kind of insight that he had. It also entails him sloughing off this burden of this corpse and awakening all of a sudden where it's almost like Satori in the Zen sense. He has like an enlightenment experience that then, you know, kind of issues forth this new levity. It's a proclamation of like how we're going to live with one another in a way that's lightened, enlightened, and unburdened. I don't know, Devin. What do you think?
I cannot overstate the importance of this moment of rest, actually. And this will, excuse me, to some extent go back to some of the wackier parts of Loeb's reading that I find interesting. But the sentence is actually a little more specific. Long Zarathustra slept, and not only the dawn passed over his face, but the morning as well. So I take the temporal, again, the temporal passage of the sun. And here, you know, this is potentially a shift beyond the kind of Neoplatonic image of the sun as the symbol for that which is the good beyond being, that is therefore timeless and permanent. It's essential for the symbolism of Zarathustra that the sun traffics across the sky throughout the course of the day, and that corresponds to different moments in the development of life. But what we have here is a sense in which Zarathustra sleeps, dawn passes over him and morning, and he wakes up instead. Well, if we follow Nietzsche's kind of chronology, the next moment would be at noon. And this suggests that this passage should be seen as a direct precursor to the passage of the noontide in the fourth book, where Zarathustra, again, rests at a tree. And that will entail a kind of fundamental shift in perspective between Zarathustra at this moment, where his first rest is a realization of the moment that he needs to search for companions and thus move towards a kind of selective audience rather than kind of dispensing his gift indiscriminately, suggesting again the move towards a kind of selective principle to which he'll have to subject himself. And then Zarathustra at the end of the book, or close to the end of the book, because it's the noontide passage comes about midway through book four, as you might expect. Where Zarathustra, we think, is getting close to the point of fully incorporating and accepting the doctrine of eternal return and is sort of guiding the higher men to their inevitable end or going under and their transformation. So yes, I think this moment is quite important, not just in the sense that Zarathustra is resting, but also in the sense of the passage of time being decisively marked. And you should all, and you can also see, you know, in the Cambridge translation, you get in the subsequent lines, he says, and thus he spoke to his heart, it dawned on me, I need companions. It dawned on me, let Zarathustra speak not to the people, but instead to companions. Again, this idea of it being, in the German being Erlicht, you know, the reference to light and dawning in that sense. That this is a kind of symbol of revelation where Zarathustra is undergoing a moment of metamorphosis that kind of corresponds to one of the moments in that famous three metamorphoses passage that will come directly after the prologue. And I do think this marks the beginning of a movement that does not complete itself until part four. Now, the wacky aspect of this that I kind of mentioned earlier is there's some debate over when Zarathustra's narrative actually does complete itself. The kind of traditional reading that, for example, Gooding Williams subscribes to is that the fourth book is indeed intended to mark the final kind of culmination of Zarathustra's journey and his ascent to acceptance of the eternal return. Paul Loeb has a different reading in which we should actually locate book four chronologically prior to the end of book three, with book three, the end of book three, then marking the moment of Zarathustra's death and rebirth into one and the same life, and thus the absolute kind of culmination of his acceptance of the eternal return. So I'm not sure which of these readings I necessarily subscribe to. I think I still need to spend time, you know, working through Zarathustra more before I feel I can come down on one side of that debate, but it is an interesting debate, I think.
The riskier premise that I want to put forward is that if we're speaking in metaphorical terms, I think the shift that we see at the end of the prologue also is Zarathustra's challenge to the oppositionalism inherent in the orthodoxy that he wants to take down. Insofar as we get a flavor of the dialectic in the herdsman, the master-slave thing, and what he is attempting to invoke is this paradigm beyond that. And this is where I connect the sort of against Hegelianism that we see in Deleuze. And then now here's my challenge to Will, is that I do think there is, I think there's a very salient interpretation and reading of Deleuze that sees this very aspect of Zarathustra as being positioned against Hegelianism because it plumbs the depths of this sort of subject predicate oppositionalism that we see on the surface, and Deleuze trying to get beyond those sort of abstract permutations and locate beneath them the sort of motivating forces, a will. I mean, Zarathustra's character even says that, like, that together with these people who follow themselves, we will find, you know, a will together, at least in some instances anyway.
But I think there's an important caveat to add here. And let's look at the last passage, the last sentence of, or two sentences of section 9, where he says, I want to go to my goal and I go my own way. Over the hesitating and dawdling, I shall leap. Thus let my going be there going under. So I think Zarathustra here is directly comparing himself and identifying himself with the jester character in the tightrope walker metaphor allegory. Who leaps over the tightrope walker and is the cause of his tragic downfall. Noting again that downfall or destruction or doom is another translation of Untergang or going under, in indicating the kind of tragic dimension of this. But I do think this is Zarathustra. This is an important moment that will not be the final moment in Zarathustra's development. So this is Zarathustra in some sense assuming the role of the lion and repudiating the thou shalt values of the herd. And also breaking with and repudiating those who's the herd that still accepts them in search of these kind of exceptions who could be perhaps better suited to his teaching. But it's equally important that this attempt on Zarathustra's part, this attempt to escape from the problem by becoming the lion, is also destined to fail, that Zarathustra will again be confronted with the mass of humanity, what he be kind of unexceptionable or last man, and forced to reckon and overcome him in the kind of prospect that even the small man returns, that the will be of willing the eternal return also means willing the return of nihilism, willing the return of decadence, et cetera, et cetera. And this will, in passages like The Convalescent in book three, this will prove to be Zarathustra's kind of deepest challenge, his great disgust that he has to overcome before he becomes capable of willing the eternal return, and thus becoming the child, passing from the phase of the lion who can only deny or negate values, can only deny thou shalt, to the innocence of the child who can create values anew. So I think that's another important aspect of this passage to call attention to here. This is a moment in Zarathustra's journey that will be marked by other important moments and kind of the plot development. But again, to go back to what Will said earlier, we really do have to center Nietzsche's cosmology and the laying out of the doctrine of the eternal return through the developing drama of Zarathustra.
Anything else? Will, did you want to respond to my challenge?
A reply. I mean, I think ultimately what we have to like, if you just want to like literarily understand what Nietzsche as a strange kind of protagonist is going through, the half mole, half man figure, I think, is one helpful way to see precisely why like a particular kind of Platonism is what Nietzsche's actually after. I really. Like, because for Nietzsche, I really don't think that Hegel is possible, particularly his Christology, which I think is actually the thing that why Zarathustra can be, in a certain sense, also understood as a kind of Dionysus crucified. Like for all of these things to occur, again, the mendacious concept of the arrival at eudaimonia through the perpetual teleological direction towards the singular good is, I think, the fundamental limitation for Nietzsche, and it's the metaphysics that he's overturning.
But you can easily read Hegel as the culmination of that metaphysics, right?
Yeah, but
there is a bit of a false dichotomy here.
Yeah, perhaps, but I think that there's also something sort of since the birth of tragedy where metaphysics as such is part of the problem.
Yes.
And that you can't reduce to Hegel at all.
No, I agree with that.
And it's also like Deleuze is fundamentally the kind of metaphysician Nietzsche would probably also ultimately be uncomfortable with.
Well, I think Nietzsche is too in certain moments, right?
Yeah,
in his notes, he's also trying to be a metaphysician.
Yeah, and I think ultimately that's why, you know, what is it? It's in the Question Concerning Technology book that's sort of rather recent, but Nietzsche's word is a helpful way to understand like the post kind of Heideggerian critique of Nietzsche as a kind of metaphysician. I still think that Platonism is the fundamental problem for Nietzsche.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think Will is clearly right. The symbolism that's parodying Neoplatonism is abundant throughout the book. I think Deleuze's reading of that tries to establish Nietzsche as Hegel's great opponent is a productive one. I think it's a kind of an optical illusion when it comes to Nietzsche's text, in that the most influential thinker for Nietzsche remains Schopenhauer, even though he rejects Schopenhauer's metaphysics. And of course, Schopenhauer's great enemy was Hegel. So I think there's a sense in which, because he is inheriting a version of kind of the Kantian critical project through Schopenhauer, I think we have reason to believe, for example, that the main source Nietzsche has for Kant's, at least Kant's first critique, is Schopenhauer's appendix to The World and Will, World as Will and Representation, on his critique of Kantian philosophy. But it's very much filtered through a philosopher who at least defined himself as anti-Hegelian to his core. There's no evidence, as far as I'm aware of, that Nietzsche actually read Hegel, or at least in any kind of depth or seriousness. So certainly, I think as a biographical claim about Nietzsche's intentions, it's pretty implausible relative to Will's much more plausible claim that the target is Platonism, given that we have as early as the early 1870s, Nietzsche describing his philosophy as an inverted Platonism. Very early on.
I certainly agree with that. I thought the claim was that Deleuze didn't see Hegel as a target through Nietzsche.
Oh, Maybe I just misheard.
Yeah.
No, I mean...
I mean, it's on the page.
It's literally like...
Yeah.
I mean, Deleuze is clinging for like dear life to a stray phrase in Ecce Homo about Nietzsche's reevaluation of Birth of Tragedy, which... perhaps that would be another like ask a left Nietzschean topic would be like the Dionysian and the Apollonian, because I actually don't think that's an easily understood concept. I've taken two graduate courses. I still don't really understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that would be another topic to pin down. But yeah, no, I think that Deleuze really wants to produce, for example, a Hume that can respond to Kant. So he obviously wants to produce a Spinoza that can respond to Hegel. Yeah. And he's going to try to use Nietzsche to do that.
Well, to his credit, I think what Deleuze does do that nobody else I'm aware of has really taken quite as seriously is trying to cash out the inner logic of these discussions of force and will and quanta of power that we get in Nietzsche's Nachlass, and that there's enough of, I mean, it's all over the place to think that Nietzsche, one, took it seriously as a kind of physical, as perhaps what he saw as our best account of physics as he understood it. Mm. But also that's deeply connected to the eternal return, that the eternal return theoretically follows from this logic of the world being understood as relations between quanta of will or quanta of force, and that Nietzsche will make arguments about why that necessarily implies infinite time and eternal return. Deleuze, I think, to his credit, he takes this stuff seriously. He actually tries to work through the kind of the logic that Nietzsche is in piecemeal fashion mapping out in some of his fragments. And that's something I definitely learned a lot about, mostly because of Deleuze's book.
Well, I think the confluence of these understandings and misunderstandings does bring us back to one of the original questions. And I mean, I'll have to reassert this claim, which is that I think what's happening in the prologue is that in challenging the orthodox epistemology, ethics, and so on. And if we read it through a Deleuzean lens, I think what Nietzsche is after, I mean, at least what Deleuze thinks Nietzsche is after, for example, is that something like the dialectic is insufficient because it's incapable of knowing the concrete phenomenon, the forces and wills, because it utilizes this binarized abstract framework with which to determine anything, really. And so part of what sort of plumbing that binary means and breaking it involves establishing a new epistemology and a set of epistemological relations. And it brings us back to the question of what kind of ideal would be worthy to put above mankind. And so with that said, like with everything that we said, what kind of idea would he be willing to put above mankind? Like what would be the sort of shape or contour of that?
Yeah. I think Nietzsche holds kind of two things. One, that the ideal or value would have to be one that is of a kind of self-renewing kind, one that allows for further development and self-overcoming and is dynamic in some sense, therefore incorporating or remaining immanent to the motion of world will to power rather than seeking to transcend it. And I do think that this is where we get to the kind of tougher questions about Nietzsche's politics. I don't think you can deny that I think we can have very important debates about how we ought to understand and situate Nietzsche's defense of aristocratic radicalism in sections, for example, like book 9 of Beyond Good and Evil on What is Noble, where I think he's quite explicit. Now, in Ecce Homo, he will say, when he transitions from talking about Zarathustra to Beyond Good and Evil, that his task was clearer now than ever that the yes-saying part of his philosophy was done. It was now time for the no-saying part. And so Beyond Good and Evil is very squarely situated in this no-saying part, an attempt to destroy the history of nihilism rather than to expound the positive ideal. That's the teaching of Zarathustra. But at the same time, he does seem throughout his work to recur to an idea that a very extreme form of moral perfectionism in which only a very select few individuals that come about extremely rarely provide the kind of imaginative, artistic, creative justification for human existence that is sufficient to really overcome the problem of nihilism. And it's important, I think, to draw further contrast between that and his kind of aristocratic sense. These don't perfectly map onto each other. Nietzsche's argument is not to identify the aristocrats with these exceptional geniuses, which come around much more rarely than any aristocrats in an established class would. And two, he construes mostly sometimes he calls them lucky hits, these kind of freak accidents that can never be anticipated, right? That no program on the part of a culture could necessarily intentionally produce, but will come about importantly by chance, at least to some degree. But he does seem to make an argument about the conditions out of which this kind of genius can grow are ones that involve some kind of caste structure to society. And I do think this is the part of Nietzsche's politics that is clearly reactionary and that we have to grapple with. And the question we need to ask is whether, given that once we clearly disentangle these different levels of Nietzsche's claim, we can accept Nietzsche's view that some kind of higher, even religious form of aesthetic, artistic affirmation in this world really is sufficient, it really is necessary to sustain any kind of moral commitments or values we have, even if they're to rational autonomy and the emancipatory project of modernity. And then ask whether he is correct to view these kinds of social arrangements as necessary to produce that kind of justification, or rather whether we can conduct a kind of eminent critique of Nietzsche at precisely this point and show how Nietzsche's own anxieties, forms of decadence or self-doubt creep into his attempt to create an aristocratic caste society that perhaps might not actually be well suited to yielding the kind of aesthetic justification of existence he values.
Yeah, you almost answered the question that I was going to ask. In fact, you probably did, but maybe you could say a bit more about it, sure. Which is there something within Nietzsche's own philosophy, like of the eternal return, for example, that then does undermine that reactionary tendency, or even more broadly, the developmental narrative of history?
Yes. There's one passage in particular I would call attention to. I don't have it offhand right now. I'll try to find it and give it to you later so viewers can have the reference. But it's a passage in the Nachlass where he specifically describes how the eternal return is first understood by no one, then a few, and then finally by everyone. So there are suggestions that this kind of caste structure is a kind of transitional moment of a certain extent. Albeit one that he perhaps thinks is going to dominate a long trajectory of the future, right? Before we reach a kind of humanity that as a whole can affirm the eternal return. But what I typically try to stress is that I do think there is a deep tension between Nietzsche's attempts to circumscribe that ideal and the kind of selection it implies, and sort of cut it to make it particular, whether it's unique to European culture, or specifically masculine or whatever else, I think there is an aspiration towards humanity as a whole throughout Nietzsche's work that cuts directly against that kind of particularism. And I think that it does come out in the eternal return that any kind of particularist interpretation would in some sense form a restriction on how profound the thought is supposed to be and the function of breaking history in two that it is supposed to perform. It is supposed to break humanity as a whole in two. And in some sense, this is anticipating a culture of universal humanity. Now, we can disagree with what Nietzsche has, what his particular views for that culture. But I think this is an example where something that Bataille gets right, for example. Bataille, I think, quite clearly notices the ways this extravagant, mad ambition can overflow, and precisely the image in Nietzsche's image, overflow the limits that Nietzsche himself tries to place on it and aspire to a kind of grand universal picture of humanity.
Great. I don't want to leave Charles or Will out of this discussion. Charles, did you want to add anything to any of the points that have been made?
I would just like to add that if I were the answer
in a pithy way what I see as Nietzsche's answer to the question of what ideal we could put above human. It would be to see human beings as a creative potential, as a kind of infinite creative potential, which historically has generated new values by the exception, by the exceptional individual, but in principle is not limited to the exception. It's something that in the future of the Übermensch could be unleashed and engulf all of humankind.
See, what Charles just said points to what I think might be a tension, maybe even a kind of antinomy in Nietzsche's thought. And I was hoping we could contend with that a bit here. Going back to the prologue, the long rest and repose, often the bombastic language of Nietzsche is put into the foreground in such a way, you know, that it forms this caricature that we've confronted at the top of the episode. And I often wonder to what extent the idea of passivity is either in the shadow of human creative potential. And maybe even, I would ultimately attempt to avoid ascribing, you know, a gendered quality to masculine and feminine, you know, to creative and passivity exclusively. But it seems that, you know, Nietzsche's disparagement of the passive in some way might attend to the way that he disparages the feminine in certain instances. Mm-hmm. I wonder, like, what could you say about that, Devin?
I think there's a deep antinomy here. I think it's deliberate on Nietzsche's part and is consistent throughout his work. So action, activity, which he associates with the masculine kind of gender, he associates gendered in a gendered way with the masculine and masculine values, is often associated with the kind of attacking, overcoming aspects of will to power. Another figure of will to power that comes up very frequently is pregnancy. Nietzsche describes himself as a pregnant elephant on one occasion when it comes to the gestation of his works. He describes the act of artistic inspiration as a kind of pregnancy. And that is a different side of the will to power. It's a side of will to power that emphasizes enduring or bearing, the enduring or bearing of suffering as a form of resistance that is then overcome for the sake of some kind of higher goal. And I think that that proves to be the deeper figure of will to power than the masculine attacking one, which I think is associated more with his naysaying doctrine than his yes-saying doctrine. And I think that one of the ways in which this clearly comes up is the concept of amor fati, or loving one's fate, right? So this seems to suggest the kind of ultimate passivity or ultimate kind of quietism, right? It can be seen as kind of a Buddhist renunciation of action in favor of a meditative acceptance of letting beings be, or something along those lines. But I think that this is, again, a place where things are more complicated for Nietzsche, where Nietzsche is using this figure of seemingly extreme quietism and passivity to symbolize the kind of absolute apex of activity, in a sense. And I think one reason for that is, as I think when you read through Zarathustra, you'll see that the eternal return is importantly related to how we grant being and reality and affirmation to this one moment, this moment now, you know, this gateway moment in the vision of the riddle, right? And the problem is that this moment, the present, is always constituted in its passing. It seems to stand in for the transience of time that resists what, you know, the metaphysical tradition takes to be the eternal good. But what Nietzsche is going to try to show, as I read it, is that your one life, in all of its activity and the necessity that imbues its activity, is only individuated and affirmed as the life it is in returning. That in this moment of return, of accepting the return here and now, I constitute myself in Nietzsche's sense as somehow absolutely, finally, as a self. That give the self the kind of mediation between being and becoming is complete. And so in that sense, the moment of amor fati is also a moment of reclaiming and affirming and willing, you know, both what happens to you and what you do as the individual person you are.
Great. Will, want to pop in there?
I mean, obviously, the will to power is going to be the fundamental characteristic of beings. I mean, that, like, right. I do think like Heidegger's correct there. Mm-hmm. But I think is ultimately interesting is, you know, we were talking about before we went live, we were talking about how there's kind of like this unitary picture of French Nietzscheanism, where it's like it's these handful of figures in the 60s who were sort of circled around the project of collecting Nietzsche's works. But obviously there's a tradition before Bataille. And one of the sort of interesting questions I sort of want to put forward is, rather than seeing the eternal return as that which allows us to ground a metaphysics of becoming, if we just contend with, like, if we just accept whatever, like, it could be wrong, but if we just accept the sort of the linearity that might be in place in parts of the eternal return, if we accepted the eternal return as sort of evident of a kind of fundamental groundlessness that then we can sort of either treat as an existential imperative, or as a sort of fundamental activity of freedom. Like, I think that, like, if we had to distill sort of a Nietzschean ethic, it would be a kind of moralism that sort of refuses everything self-evident, or at least refuses the self-evidence of the self-evident. And I think that the eternal return, in a way, can sort of allow for us to refute the most basic or necessary components of any given metaphysics, which is the presupposition of a time that is not at all determined by beings. So I think that that sort of, like, eternal return as a kind of eternal refusal might be something that would be interesting to look into. And I know that there at least is some interest in this, and it's already been pursued by some folks. I think like Foucault, I think, sort of quietly being one of them, even though he, like, never actually cites Nietzsche. But I wonder if eternal return is almost not just a personal imperative, but two things, like a relationship to the tragedy of history. Like, do you actually understand that the tragedy is necessary? Or not, I don't like that. That the tragedy is what is to be affirmed. The presupposition of time, either in, you know, the Kantian acquisition of Newton and the placement of that at the condition of the transcendental unity of apperception, like, it's that transposition that I think Nietzsche will question. And I think that I would probably call power, but I think that that would be sort of my relationship to the ethics of that question.
Devin, before we close things down today, and then I have a question for Charles as well too. We're three of us in the room. Out of four of us are working on a book called One or Several Nietzsches, which will be a compilation of insights about Nietzsche, and with perhaps a common thread that is strung through them. Maybe you can talk about what it is that we'll see in that book from you, and maybe on any other sort of Nietzsche stuff that you're working on right now.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of this, Craig. So I think my contribution to One or Several Nietzsches is going to focus on trying to make sense of the concept of a gay science or joyous wisdom and the idea of the individual as experiment that Nietzsche outlines in this book. Mm-hmm. And I want to go through the way that this develops in conjunction with Nietzsche's thought about the eternal return. I'm going to try to build a narrative of how the gay science, rather than seeing the eternal return as coming up only at the end of the gay science or the end of book four, I want to give an interpretation in which it's already kind of the implicit guiding thought of the rest of gay science as a preparation for Zarathustra. And this preparation is going to center on the a kind of affirmative critique of those inherited structures that have constituted the individual subject and the experimental practice through which one both frees oneself from those constraints, but also incorporates them in some fashion as part of oneself. So, I mean, you can see this as a kind of You could see this in a Hegelian sense, but I want to say that Nietzsche offers a kind of different account of this practice than a dialectical Hegelian one. And so I think this is relates to some extent to, you know, my broader project is that I've talked about on here a couple times is a study of Nietzsche's madness, or particularly the role of madness in Nietzsche's thought and the role his own experiences of sickness and madness play in illuminating his philosophy. And this kind of fracturing of individuality that is at the heart of not only the concept of individual's experience, but it goes back to the idea of Dionysus and his dismemberment that Nietzsche discusses in Birth of Tragedy, that is kind of the source of individuation in the world. It touches on Zarathustra's animals and the various figures of kind of versions of himself that Zarathustra is in conversation with throughout the book that I take to be kind of figures of Nietzsche's unconscious in important ways. And so I'm interested in kind of in the connection between the two. I'm interested in the ways in which Nietzsche's style performatively dismantles his own individuality and kind of along an axis that explores inner duality and conflict through the contrast between kind of heights and depths and sickness and health, but one that also explores kind of inner multiplicity that doesn't have this dual relationship, but is always already a kind of inner plurality that comes up more, I think, in Zarathustra. And that's really going to be the focus, I guess you can see, is the overarching theme of the project. And we'll talk about, I do plan to focus on some of the questions of the eternal return and how that has been related to Nietzsche's experience of madness by people like Klosowski and others.
Great. And Charles, now being on Moral Minority, perhaps you can talk about some future ideas and episodes that we will see there. And how does what you're working on in Moral Minority play into any other kind of research interests that you have right now?
Well, thank you very much for the question. Thank you for having both Devin and I on. In the future, my Moral Minority, we will be turning to existentialism. We'll have an extensive series of episodes exploring different versions of existentialism, including Kierkegaard, which I see to have a great affinity, perhaps an accidental affinity with Nietzsche, particularly in the concept of the eternal return. It would be a mistake to interpret the eternal return as merely a psychological principle, something we pragmatically adopt, that it is good for us to view each moment as if we will it and we would will it eternally. In exactly the same way. Rather, we have to read both Kierkegaard and Nietzsche as advocating a metaphysical principle. With Nietzsche, you get the eternal return as something that is actually true on a deep metaphysical level. And with Kierkegaard, it takes the form a bit more Hegelian in terminology, but I think in spirit of the choice as choosing infinitely. Of course, Kierkegaard inherits some Christian conceptions of a unified self, which Nietzsche obviously doesn't share, but with both Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, we get this importance, this return to or reimagining of a metaphysics wherein that we can will or we can choose, and by thus choosing, we create values for ourselves. So I think that will be a theme of future episodes of Moral Minorities, whether we can have this Promethean sense of morality wherein we create values, and that is the source.
Yeah, and our next episode will focus on kind of the opposite of this as well, then the contrasting picture. We're going to talk about Bernard Williams' Shame and Necessity, which will return to Nietzsche and tragedy in a big way, and the failures of that kind of sovereign agency, the need to take responsibility, sometimes in a shamed way, for things that happened to us or that we did involuntarily, and what problems that introduces into moral life and our own sense of our freedom. But yeah, the existentialism is on the horizon as well, and I'm very excited for it.
Well, once again, it was great having both Devin and Charles on the show today. The episode or the live stream started with a little bit of a cock-up, as they say, a small comedy of errors, and we break into Devin just talking about, I think, Moral Minority or some of his research. That's fine. I'll edit it nice and clean. All of the mistakes will be Stalinized, as we say around here. And the next time we have a major eruption in Nietzschean discourse on Twitter, that will be our signal to meet again. And so we hope to have you back sometime in the future to talk about something else, perhaps the Dionysian.
Sounds great to me. Thanks so much for having us on.
All right. Take care. It was great to have both of you.
All right, you too, guys. Craig. Well.